Well, hello everybody, and thank you for tuning in to this special holiday edition of the Doo Doo Diva Smells Like Money podcast. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. Instead of having a guest, we're going to bring you recaps and small segments of some of our most popular podcasts over our seasons here. But before we jump into that, I just want to take this time to thank all of you who have tuned in, have participated and come on the show with me as a guest, and especially my staff who puts together these podcasts for me and promotes them out on LinkedIn, because without all of you, none of this and the success we've enjoyed would have been possible. So a very happy holiday season, happy new year, and may we all be blessed with prosperity and an abundance of health, wealth, and love this season and into the coming year. So I hope you enjoy this special recap of the Doo Doo Diva podcast. And again, thank you for tuning in and happy holidays. All right. So in terms of fraud, what actually falls under that bucket of quote unquote fraud? Like, we always think of that as, big felonies, the FBI involved and, hauling people off to jail and lock them up and throw away the key. But from what you've shared with me before we came on the show, it can actually be more subtle than that. And many of my listeners right now, you may not be aware of it, but it's quite possible that you yourself right now, unknown, could be falling victim to fraud. And so let's talk about that.
Happy to do it. Fraud, let me just give you a definition of fraud first. This is just kind of a plain English definition. It's an intentional misrepresentation that's relied upon by another to their disadvantage. It has to be, there's no such thing as an accidental fraud. It has to be intentional. I have to lie to you with the idea that I want to take advantage of you. You have to believe the lie, and then you have to suffer damages as a result. And if you'd like, I can illustrate that with a little magic trick.
Sure, go ahead.
Just a quick one. This is an illustration of fraud. You've heard of three-card Monte, right?
Yes.
I'm told that more money has been won and lost on this game than every horse race ever won. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know this. Anybody can play and anybody can win. All you have to do is follow the lady, the Queen of Hearts. Pay no attention to the Nine of Clubs, no attention to the Nine of Spades. Just follow the lady. Now, if you were paying attention, you'd be feeling pretty good about yourself right now. But had you placed a bet, you'd have been a fraud victim because I lied. Nobody can win this game. I also cheated. There never was a Queen of Hearts.
Wow. Wow.
Just a little bit of fun.
Okay.
So fraud takes a whole variety of shapes and forms and sizes. They're not all felonies. The ones that catch our attention tend to be the big financial statement frauds, and they cause the greatest amount of damage. But the things that affect most individuals and most organizations are more subtle, and they tend to involve asset misappropriation. That's people who are trying to get their hands on physical things that they can convert to their own personal use. Equipment, materials, most often it's cash. About 90% of all the business fraud takes place like that. And you mentioned earlier that you may be a victim of fraud. It's actually quite likely that you'll be a victim of fraud. 5% of every dollar that comes in the door is lost to fraud. That's the estimate by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners. And frankly, I've seen instances where I think it's much higher than that. I've seen it put people out of business entirely. So it's a really significant threat, I think, to most organizations. And it's something everybody needs to be aware of. And that's really the big issue. People just aren't aware of how susceptible they are or how prevalent the problem is.
What's the average loss, in North America?
In North America, the average loss has come out to about $1.5 million. And it's 647,000 is the median for people in North America and Canada. And it's about $1.5 million, actually closer to 2 million on average. So you've got those great big frauds that are affecting the numbers. But It's a very big problem, a big issue.
How long does it take? I mean, it seems like, I would imagine to reach that level, it's got to be done very, very slowly. Otherwise, the fraudster would get caught very, very quickly. So you know, what does it usually take? And then I guess the biggest question is, how can a business owner or any entity, any organization, spot that something might be off? What are some of the red flags that they should be more alert to so that they can prevent it or stop it before it gets to that, you know, million and a half level?
Excellent questions. And what's typically been the case is it's usually taken about 18 months from the time a fraud begins until it stops. It's been reduced a little bit in the last survey that we did. Every 2 years, the ACFE does a survey. It's based on 2,000 actual cases. So this isn't people making things up. It's 2,000 cases, and the average in the last survey was 12 months. But for the types of fraud that most affect business, like wastewater companies and government entities, it takes about 18 months for a billing fraud from the time it starts until the time it ends. In my own personal experience, once you get to a year, you're almost always talking about $1 million. It's just staggering. The really smart ones, if they understand where the fences are and they keep their heads down, they can go on and steal indefinitely and never get caught. It depends on how good the internal controls are in the organization and how aware they are, but it's very significant. The other thing you were asking me about is red flags. About 85% of the time, people who are committing fraud will show some red flags. There are three components to every fraud: an immediate need, an opportunity to do it, and the ability to rationalize behavior. The immediate need is something that lives with inside the fraudster. I call it the unshareable problem. And it's typically them being under some kind of a pressure that they can't share with anyone, and it might cause them to do something that they wouldn't ordinarily do. Most fraudsters have never done anything wrong in their lives when they get caught.
Well, now, when you were saying that it's flexible and it requires, you know, a very small footprint, how does this compare, when you were saying with the multiple blends and sealing the joints, does it actually adhere to the walls, or is it creating similar to that thought process of a slip lining or CIPP, a pipe within a pipe, if we were to compare it so that people can understand that, everybody understands what that is?
So, you know, we can oversimplify it a little bit by saying, you know, if we use AWWA's classification, you know, we're somewhere between a class 3 and a class 4, right? Because we are handling all the structural, pressures. We're handling that. Exterior loading, we're not taking that into consideration. The hose pipe simply becomes a conduit for our liner. In other words, once we pull our liner in, the process is we pull this in. It's an advanced form of slip lining. We fold up the liner into a C shape. We tape that up, and then we pull it in. You talked about the small footprint. So our pipe comes on a spool. So you're already talking about a reduced carbon footprint when you're talking about the transportation and handling of the pipe, because we actually fold it up. So there's no wasted space. We're not shipping air, right? We fold it up, we put that on a drum. And the drum can be from 3 meters wide or 1.5 meters wide up to 11 meters wide, depending on the application. So again, there's a lot of versatility and flexibility with Primus Line as it relates to a specific project. Sometimes it requires a 10-ton winch to pull it in, right? So other times it could potentially be pulled in by hand. So we've had actual projects where it was 90 feet in length and that product was actually pulled in by hand, but you couldn't have gotten any of these other technologies in place because this actually can snake into those spots. We then pull it in place, we inflate it, put our end connectors on, and in the industry you hear the term end seal for other conventional technologies. And we're not an end seal. Ours is a connector. So the difference between us and other technologies is that we guarantee 100% leak-proof connections from point A to point B, right? From end to end.
Well, how are you able to do that?
So the way we're able to do that is really through our connectors. So we have a German standard and an ISO standards that we have to conform to. So every single line, the quality control and quality assurance that is taken during the manufacturing process is really second to none in the world, because we actually, as we manufacture it during the entire process, from bringing in the material, the pellets that we use for the polyethylene coating on the inside and the outside, all of that is gone through quality assurance, quality control. So all that virgin material is processed. It's brought into our extruder. We have a loom that manufactures the weave for the Kevlar, creating the tube. And then we have two co-extruders. During that process, we have these optical sensors that are measuring the thickness circumferentially during the whole entire process. If anything comes out of spec, you know, that thousandth of an inch, it's going to stop immediately. We're going to rectify that problem, rectify that situation, and then we go ahead and continue back into service. So it's really and when we manufacture it, we take a sample and we do destructive testing on that liner. And that's a requirement. That's part of that standard, especially for gas, is we have to document that. It's uploaded to a secure cloud and can be accessed by the German government for verification. And it's videotaped. So we do destructive testing. We use our end connectors with the liner, and we test that to failure. And the liner will fail every single time before the connectors. And that's an important distinction, because that's the number one area where you have problems with conventional rehabilitation methodologies, is where it connects back to the hose pipe, right? So, and that's the difference. The distinction is we're not sealing the ends, we're connecting it back to the hose pipe.
And maybe I should ask this question. How do you see the people that are contractors, that are fantastic technicians? What do they need to work on skill set wise to be good managers? Like, what do they have to focus on to make that shift from being a technician to being an entrepreneur? Because that's really what it is. Yeah. It's going from the field into entrepreneurship. It's a big leap.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you're talking my language right now. So, right. So I have to get out of my head a little space to start talking marketing and developing, you know, that's out of my headspace, but you're talking right in my headspace right now. And it's funny. I literally had this conversation over dinner with one of our suppliers who was in town yesterday, which is why I was out on a job site till 1:30 this morning with him, as we were doing night work. And we over dinner had this exact conversation. I like to say we all have ceilings. And that's not always the nicest thing to say, but we all have a ceiling. I have a ceiling. You have a ceiling. People have ceilings, right? I'm a very, very big proponent of understanding your strengths and weaknesses and accepting them. I like to surround myself with people who have different strengths than me, who, you know, so that we, what's the word? I'm sleep deprived. Well,
you shore each other up.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, you fill the gap that they have, and they fill the gap that you have, and together you make a strong.
Exactly. Foundation. Yeah. There's a perfect word for that, but I can't think of it at the moment. But that's okay. But you're right. So that we work together and we fill each other's voids, and we, you know, support each other. And you know, I'm a huge proponent of that. Right. In this industry, I see a lot, and we've had these conversations through previous employers that I've had, and we've had, you know, some people agree, some people disagree, but you know, we promote people a lot of times for the wrong reasons. Superintendents coming from the field, unfortunately, are the ones that it happens to more than any. It may be that they are, you know, 50, 52 years old, and physically the demands are really tough on that position. And they, I don't want to say they age out, but physically it becomes tougher. But they've been a good employee. They have a wealth of knowledge that you don't want to lose. So you find some kind of role that fits for them. You call them an operations manager or an assistant operations manager, or you try to put them on a project management track to get them out of the field. you do those type things, and it's tough, right? I get it. There's a human element to it, right? That person's been a great employee for you. And I understand all of that. But, you know, back to what you said, you're putting them in a position not to succeed. And at the end of the day, you're happy because you may be making more money. You're happy because you're not out in the field doing and you know, beating your body up, you know, doing hard manual labor. But you're also not happy because you're not fulfilled because you're not doing a great job. You're doing something that you're fighting to create, to do a job that you don't have a skill set that and you're trying to learn. So it's a really, really difficult situation. It's difficult conversations. One of the problems that I think is that we tend to want to set caps on, you know, salary or earning caps on positions, right? So someone's been here long enough that they are capped out as a superintendent. And we get this mentality that we can't pay a superintendent more than that. So now that he's due for a raise, he's got to go on to a project management track because I can pay a project manager more than a superintendent. But he doesn't have the skill set, so we try to square peg round hole because John's due for a raise and now I can't pay him that much as a superintendent. And I think that's really narrow-minded thinking because at the end of the day, if John's a really, really good superintendent, he's your best superintendent, he's more valuable to you as a superintendent than a subpar project manager making more money.
So let's talk about that, because one of the things that you had mentioned, and it's a little bit of a little yuck factor, but that when you have the SSOs in the streets doing a big rain event, and then what people don't think about, maybe we need to think about it, but we try not to think about it, is that the water evaporates, but the stuff that was in that water gets left on the street it dries up. Like you were saying to me earlier, all that stuff dries up in the hot Texas sun, becomes airborne. It's dust. It's on the sidewalks. It's on the lawn that your kids are rolling around in, that the dog is rolling around in. It's on your driveway. It's in the air. And it can make you sick.
Yeah, this is a health hazard that there has not been any. I have hardly seen anybody doing any kind of investigative study. But naturally, if you think about this, you have raw untreated sewage that has discharged in. I'm going to pick on Houston just because I have the most amount of information and data. Is that when we get these, you know, massive floods, depressions, hurricanes, or just big rain events, we flood out so much here in Houston because of the storm sewer system's not up to par right now either. So it's a double whammy thing. And so when you have untreated raw sewage discharge, okay, and it goes into the grass area, and you have it sitting there in the grass area, the water subsides into the grass, but the solids, the fecal matter, the bacteria, all this stuff is on the surface. It's left at the surface and it's sitting there. And then after it bakes in the sun for a couple of days, the guys come out to mow their grass. And when you mow the grass, now you spread this stuff airborne. So it's a massive health hazard that I have seen little to none studies on what the health effects are. But rest assured, when you canvas that much raw sewage and fecal matter and bacteria, like toxic bacteria that's supposed to be treated, but it's in our living environment, and we cycle this season after season after season, that's got to make people sick.
It just makes sense. Maybe you don't know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it just because it's a big hot topic right now. Can NanoBubble address some of these, you know, emerging contaminants that we are dealing with, like PFAS and other, you know, things that are coming into the plant that we've never been designed to deal with this? I don't know if it's proven, but can it help?
I'm glad you asked. We are working with some engineering consultants right now to match up probably nanobubble oxygen with maybe a metallic catalyst along with some other. It's not gonna destroy PFAS by itself. I'm certain of that. But I see enough opportunities, and we're exploring a number of them. Things like pesticides, bacteria. We can add ozone nanobubbles at the end of a treatment plant and do as good a job as the existing chlorine system. Whether we can get that past the all the the government regulations, we'll see. But I'm confident, based on the data I've seen, that the ozone nanobubbles in conjunction with possibly electrolyzed water will do a lot less hazardous than adding chlorine.
Oh, wow.
So there's another piece.
There's hope. You know, there are some now emerging technologies to deal with this. I mean, with that new legislation coming down, we've got to move fast. Sure. What about things like microplastics?
I just had somebody ask me that based on my my LinkedIn article, and we're actually doing some testing with a university right now. We already have data that shows that nanobubbles does an excellent job of floating very small particles and very low density particles. Working in the mining industry, for example, that's real important to them. So I think there's an excellent chance that we could use nanobubbles to froth flotation, which is a process to remove all those really small particles. Because nanobubbles do a real nice job of connecting to little particles that traditional bubbles don't.
Thanks so much for joining me, the Doo-Doo Diva, on this week's episode of Smells Like Money. What stood out to you this week? Share your takeaways by leaving me a review. You can find out more about the new technologies, creating sustainable solutions and insights on how to succeed in our vital industry by subscribing to the show. Whether you want to learn about the latest trends in wastewater infrastructure, treatment, or trenchless, you've got it all right here at Smells Like Money. If you're an industry expert and would like to be considered as a guest for the show, book a quick chat with me by visiting calendly.com/thetuitgroup/B-A-podcast-guest, or simply click the link in the show notes below. Until next week, a big shout out to all my industry friends and those who will be. You are my superheroes. Thanks for tuning in, keeping it flowing, and we'll see you all next week.